Okay, on the air. And so I guess the first thing I'd just ask you to state your full name, please.
Dr. David J. Murphy.
And what is your date and place of birth?
Portland, Maine, in December 20th, 1943.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and if you moved around a lot? Or that sort of thing?
No, actually, we brought up in a what they call the projects now. It was a housing development that was put up for Second World War vets. And if you made over $2,000 a year, you were disqualified for this because you were too rich. So it was a very, I wouldn't say impoverished, but it was certainly a needy area. And it was a community center that took care of a lot of the needs when people didn't have food and took care of us. It was a great place because everybody was the same. You know, no one had anything more than the next person. So it was homogeneous in that way, that we were all poor, so we didn't realize we were poor until we went outside the projects.
Right, right. Wow. Yeah. How could you tell me maybe a little bit about your educational background, so like high school or...
Yeah, I was probably held back a little bit from the projects schools, that they weren't up to what the city standards would be or private schools, but I was very lucky that I was always interested in education and interested in reading and was gifted a little bit with more brains than the average guy, because we always said we sent more kids to reform school than we did to high school. And luckily we moved out of there when I was in junior high, and then I got put into a parochial school for grades 7 and 8. And found the changeover was a little bit difficult. And then I was always an altar boy and, you know, active with the Catholic Church. And my parents kind of pushed me a little bit towards the Catholic boys' school in Portland, Maine. And that was a Jesuit-run Bishop Shepherd's High School. So you had to write an entrance exam, and somehow I passed that, which is really quite amazing in itself, because my educational background wasn't bad. And one thing that really happened great, it was they had levels. They had A, B, C, and D. A and B, A was the best students, B was the second best, C was still in college bound people, and then D were just regular, I guess you would say,
just everyday.
Everyday,
folks, or,
yeah. And they really didn't care that much for that that group.
Right.
But
right.
The Jesuits were rather elitist. So somehow I passed and got into Section B. Well, my first set of marks, and we didn't know it was Parents' Night, and my mother came with me and went, and the priest said, "Well, congratulations, you have first class honors." And I had no idea what first class honors were. Mm. None, absolutely none. So I went out and found out it was all A's. So we took 7 courses all in all every year for 4 years, one being religion or theology. Mm-hmm. So 6 other courses along with that. Every day you had half sheets of paper, and every course you took a quiz on the homework from the night before. So if you were diligent, and I was, and you know, I would study in high school, I would study 2.5 hours a night. And but because I had catching up to do, I mean, really, if it wasn't for Latin, I mean, I don't know where I would have been, because I didn't know really a noun from a verb to a gerund and all that. But everybody started from zero with Latin, and with Latin, you know, it conjugated the sentence for you. It gave you all the background that I didn't have in my educational background. But it really stimulated. I loved it. You know, we did Caesar's Gaelic Wars. We did the Cicero, which Cicero was a little dry, but. You know, all kinds of things, and Ovid, and Cheekis, and all kinds of history, which I enjoy.
Oh, great! Thank you very much. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So, got through there, and the Jesuits, and actually, after my first year, I was in the Section A. You know, they moved me up because my marks were good. And the funniest thing was how elitist the Jesuits were. Father Gray was the principal of the school, and they would take everybody in. It was just all boys, so it wasn't in the, you know, sport coats, ties, shoes.
The works. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You couldn't go in running shoes. That you would, you know, they'd send you home. So we'd go in and very disciplined, and you'd stand up and he'd read out the marks. They'd like, if you were a good student, it was great. You'd stand up and say, "Oh yeah, Mr. Murphy, you have, you know, 5 A's and 2 B's. That's very good. Thank you." And then you'd have somebody like Jackie Collins. Mm-hmm. You have 4 D's and 2 E's. Have you considered the public school system, Mr. Collins? You know, so, I mean, it was like, whoa, man.
It was
these,
like that, eh?
Oh yeah, these guys were serious.
In front of everyone.
And everybody chuckled. And, gentlemen, this is not funny.
We yeah, right.
Educate you. You know, yeah, I think it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I got 5 A's and 2 B's. You know, so we went through it when high school. I played football, basketball, and baseball, and so it was a good rounded group. I was in oratorical contests, which I won. I was male lead in the play for 3 years. Male lead. We only had males, but we had some people dressed up
sure,
as females.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Those were all musicals. So we get. I had a very full, great high school experience.
Oh,
other
that's
than
great.
I get injured in my between my third and fourth junior and senior year. In my senior year, I didn't actually participate very much in athletics, and that cost me some pretty big time scholarships for football down in the States. But I ended up coming here, and my life is very full up here, and it was a wonderful thing. I try to tell all the student athletes, like, you know, you don't burn any bridges and keep your eyes and mind open, and good things will happen. And that's exactly what happened to me, you know, and coming here in 62, and it was a totally different university then.
Well, I'd like to find out some more about that. How it was a different university. Maybe first, I guess I'll say, what is your current position at St. Mary's?
Right now, I'm the Director of Athletics and Recreation.
Okay. And how did you initially arrive at St. Mary's? Was it in 1962?
Yeah, and that's a funny story in itself.
Okay.
I didn't really... How I actually ended up here was actually interesting because... Coach Loney from St. Evax somehow knew I was available, even though I hadn't played my senior year, and I had a letter from him to go to St. Evax. And that's where most of the, we sent from Sheriff's High School, we sent a lot of kids to St. Evax. They were the ones that didn't have a whole lot of money, and it was a good bargain, and they went. Then the other kids from like the Division A would go to Boston College, Holy Cross, you know, which were Jesuit schools, Georgetown, and some actually defied the Jesuits and went to Harvard, which they really, they in Dartmouth, they weren't happy about that because they weren't Catholic schools.
You
but
don't say.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So I mean, we had a pretty good school, great background. So I guess I'm going to go to St. Evax. So I ran into my cousin who for some reason ended up, and he graduated from St. Mary's in 1960. So I'm getting ready, and I said to him, I said, well, yeah, I get this letter from, you know, Coach Loney. I'm thinking, he goes, oh no, you don't want to go to X. I said, why not? He says, well, X, you know, is in Antigonish, which is a really small town. You imagine 62. He said, there's no bars there. He says, they got one restaurant that, you know, you got to buy food to get a beer. He says, they got one nursing school, and they have to be in, you know, in the residence by 11 o'clock.
Oh, curfew.
He says, He says, you go to Halifax. He says, all kinds of bars. He's the biggest city. You know, he says, you got all kinds of activities to do. So, as I tell everybody, I made the academic choice and chose the Jesuits.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And ended up here. So, to get here, I'm talking to a guy who was ahead of me at Cheverus and played football. I knew he played football for St. Evax, Jimmy Hamilton. And I said, well, how do you get to school? He says, the only way to go is by train. I goes, really? I said, okay, not having a lot of money and knowing that, you know, I wasn't going to fly, that's for sure. So okay, so how do we do that? And he says, well, my parents, then I'll come pick you up. And he says, and I'll show you how to do it. I said, great. So he picks me up. I should have known. He picks me up around 11 o'clock at night. So I throw my stuff in his car with his parents, and we go to Mattawamkeag, Maine. And I defy you to look at a map of Maine and find out where Mattawamkeag is, out in the middle of nowhere. We drove for about 4 or 5 hours, and it was like an old cowboy thing, the old station. You get there, pretty much nothing's open other than that you went in and bought a ticket. That was the only thing you get, and there's no food, no nothing, just a platform. And we go, and we waited for the train to come, which came at 4 in the morning. So we get in on the train, and I'm going, this is kind of cool. Yeah, so up all night, go. We crossed at McAdam, New Brunswick,
okay.
And that was my first border crossing, and that was interesting in itself, getting all the documentation that you needed, which was pretty much nothing back in those days. You know, driver's license, that is about all you needed.
Yeah.
So we went on, and then we went to St. John, New Brunswick, and we had to change trains. And when I walked on the train, there's some girl whistled at me. I said, I think I'm in the right place.
Yeah, yeah. That's so, a good first introduction.
Yeah, good, yeah, good, yeah,
exactly.
Okay, yeah. So we, and then at Truro, because Jimmy went north to Antigonish, and I came down here and showed up to what is now the McNally Building, which wasn't completed at that time. They were still doing stonework on the north side of the building, so it was all scaffolding up. And I mean, when you actually come in that rounded driveway and you look and say, wow, this is really nice. I wonder what the rest of the campus looks like. Well, that was it. That was
right.
The whole campus. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So on the south side, on the basement, was where they had the high school. And then the Jesuits lived up above. And then in the middle part were the classrooms. And then on the north side were the residents. And on the bottom were the physics and chemistry labs were on the basement of that. So that was pretty much it. You know, that was the thing. And I went out and ran out the practice, and I looked. There was not a whole bunch of people there, and I figured they must be on another field. Mm. But and Coach Hayes was there, and he was a big man, and he's leaning on it, blacking it, and he goes, who the F are you?
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
A little less of a friendly.
Yeah,
that's
it.
Yeah.
So anyway, we worked that out.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely.
And
wow.
That was it. Yeah.
Wow. I can only imagine the campus then. It's undergone construction since I've been here.
Yeah.
So it's been just growing and growing,
well,
I guess.
This is all fields up this way. Just all fields right into the stone fence that went around the property in the back, yeah.
And what was your impression arriving of the people, and I guess of two of the campus? I mean, it would seemingly like be like something akin to driving in now from the airport. Once you leave the airport, it's just rocks and trees and skies and seas until you get into the main sort of area.
Yeah.
Did it seem like you say, oh, it looked like, well, I wonder what the rest of the campus looked like there, but there wasn't any left.
You know, you get the one great thing about athletics and sport, you know, and sports. And once I got out there and I met the guys and we started practicing and doing, you get into a routine, and it really didn't matter. You know, you get over, you got your residence room, set it up. Well, I didn't have anything set up. I came with one suitcase. That's all I
right.
Had.
Wow.
So it was pretty easy.
Yeah.
Put the stuff in the locker and
on your way.
Your days went. You had 3 practices a day. You were tired. And, you slept. You get up and, mingled with the guys. And in fact, one guy, the Bryan brothers were from Dartmouth. They said, yeah, let's go over and take over and show where we live. And I said, great. And we walked. We walked across the
oh,
town. Oh,
jeez.
Holy jeez. Where are we going?
Yeah,
That's
thinking they were taking you on a wild goose chase to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Were a lot of the people that you were practicing with, were they from around here, or were they from all over the states?
It was kind of an interesting thing. You'd never get away with it now. Mm. You know, everybody would have to, when they have football practice now, the start date is, and it's pretty solid.
Right.
You know, we had some older guys that were actually working and taking classes here. Mm. The eligibility rules in those days were far different than they are now. Mm. And I think the first practice that I was at, and it was mostly a conditioning one, I think there were probably only 12, 14 guys, and I mean, I couldn't believe that was it. But the other guys, all the American kids started coming in. There were a lot of American kids. Most of the Catholic schools down in New England would send their kids up here.
Okay.
The athletes. Also, St. Bond's Catholic school run by the Christian Brothers in Newfoundland sent a lot of kids. So the mixture of students here was far different than what it is right now. Mm. There were the Day Hops, which were the local Haligonian kids that came to school here.
Okay.
There were a tremendous amount of U.S. Students from New England, mm. and couple in Trinidad for some reason. We have some, mm. Quite a few soccer players in Trinidad. And then the Newfoundlanders made up a huge part of the other group that were here. And it's a shame that Memorial became so famous because we lost that connection. And boy, they were colorful, I'll tell you.
They were
great guys to hang out with.
That must have been some interaction, New Englanders and Newfoundlanders.
Oh,
and,
it was fabulous.
Yeah,
we were all bad.
Great, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So in 1964, you were quarterback with Steve Armitage. Am I saying that right?
Armitage.
And you led the team to an Atlantic Bowl victory against the McMaster Marauders.
That's right.
Can you tell me what it was like being a student athlete at that time? What it was like playing for the Huskies at
yeah,
the time?
Yeah, it was totally different than today. Mm-hmm. In the book, I think I brought that out in The Pursuit mm-hmm. of Excellence. You know, we were students first and athletes second, and there was no question about that. And the Jesuits made sure that's the way it was. It would be unheard of today. Like, we took six courses your first year, four-year courses, six courses your second year, and then five and five, and you graduate and you get out. And there was no BS. I mean, mm-hmm. if you didn't pass, you didn't play.
Yeah.
So you had to go to class. I remember I was bilingual in German at the time. I had taken it in high school and then got here, and they, instead of putting me in German 1, they put me in German 2. And there was only three of us in that class. So, I mean, you couldn't miss class. You'd be very, very
yeah.
good to, unless all three of us.
Somebody would notice. Yeah, exactly.
You know, they took attendance. They made sure you were here. Mm. I remember I majored in chemistry in Chem 1. I'd missed a couple of labs and everything because, not because it was football, it was because I missed the labs. And Professor Sabine came over and put his hand on my shoulder. He says, you know, Mr. Murphy, if you want to finish this course, he says, you miss one more class, he says, you're out of here. And I go, oh, okay. You know, and they would, they'd kick you out. Mm. And I needed it. I wanted to go to med school. I mean, you know, that's,
yeah.
I had to do it. So
yeah.
The academic requirements were far more stringent, and the accountability was far more stringent than it is today.
Mm. Yeah. Would you say, like, they saw athletics as very important, but the student obviously coming before athlete,
yeah.
they wanted to focus on having graduates before, like, like, where was the balance struck, do you think, in terms of being a sports school at the time versus, I mean, because I know in the United States it can be very, very driven in the sports side in some
institutions. Well, I think
that
for one thing, you had a different person coming to St. Mary's at that time. I mean, all of us, and I wouldn't say I'd say the great majority of us were blue-collar family kids who... this was the first university experience in that family. You know, we were the ones that, no one before us, you know, our parents didn't go to university. You know, I had a cousin that went, but that was about it. I had another couple cousins who were my age that were all going in this together. Mm. So the expectations were that you were going to graduate from university. So the expectations that your family had for you were that you go to school and you pass.
Mm.
And you know, it wasn't a question of doing well, because they didn't know what well was.
Mm.
You know, they didn't know if you had a B or a C or an A. You know, it was, but
right.
you're passing and you get through. So it was really quite interesting time. So your coaches, I mean, Coach Hayes, he was demanding as heck, you know, and probably Coach Baldwin in basketball, not as much, but then you got Coach Goodwin that came in after him, who was on the same wavelength as Coach Hayes, and they were very demanding. I mean, they expected the most that they could get out of you. I remember one time running sprints out there, and Hayes telling us, he says, you know, He says, the hoss is more noble than you guys, because the hoss will run until his heart explodes and he dies. He says, you guys will pass out first. Swear to God.
That's the level that they expected.
Yeah. And they got it out of us. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. And again, we didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. You know, we just all went out and we competed to the best of our abilities. I was one of the very few that did weight. There was some Bobby Rotolo and myself. There was a few of us that did weight training, mm-hmm. but that was unheard of at that time. Even at the pros, mm-hmm. they didn't do it. So I think the extra time that you had between athletics and, mm-hmm. and studies were put in differently than mm-hmm. they are now. I mean, the kids today, they're in the gym. I work out at 6:30 in the morning. You see a lot of the athletes in then, and mm-hmm. then during the day, they're all doing their weight training. They're mm-hmm. doing, you know, film studies and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I was a quarterback, so I did film studies, but no one else did. You know?
Yeah. Well, it seems that, I mean, it's not surprising when you hear that they instilled the determination, but the grit too.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it's not surprising that when another great fellow there declared that they were going to go to the moon by the end of 69. I'm not surprised he did, because you know, it was just you go or you go all the way or you don't go at all. You know.
That's right. And we didn't have limits.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know limits, you know, and that was not a bad thing.
Yeah,
you know,
no.
It's like, you know, like you try anything and keep on going and you do it to the best of your ability, and no one says, no, you can't do that. Mm. Everybody was trying to encourage you, yes, you can.
Yeah,
and
you better. Now, the front page of the SMU Journal for the 21st of November, 1964, it reads, the Huskies are preparing a two-way attack, hoping to rip apart the Marauders on the ground and in the air. So what I wanted to ask you was, how has the mindset of the teams and fans changed over the years that you've seen? You mentioned earlier that it was always packed for the games.
The whole city has changed. I mean, basically, university sport was a major event in the city. You know, so when we were playing football on a Friday night, there was nothing else going on Friday. There were no Mooseheads. There were pretty much nothing else going on. And the city kind of embraced athletics as well. And they would come out. The student body, it was unheard of that someone wouldn't go to the football game or the hockey game or the basketball game. So basically our venues were almost always full. So you're playing in front of packed houses all the time. People took an interest. They knew who you were. They followed the team. We also had two Navy teams that we played against, Shearwater Flyers and the Stadacona Sailors.
Okay.
And that was always interesting because you're playing against people that are 28 to 30, you know, some 22, 20. But there were no teenagers in there. On those teams, so it was quite a different venue, and of course they bring their fans. I mean, when they bring the Navy, you know,
that's right.
You got quite a few people showing up for that game, and it was.
It really amps it up a bit.
Yeah, it did. It put the competition up at a very high level.
Mm. Yeah. Enough so that you wanted to rip apart your opponents in the air and on the
ground. Well, I think that's
a little sensationalism.
That must have been Pat Hickey right now. that would be something. He was from Long Island, New York. So Pat would come up with words like rip apart. No, as individuals, we went out to compete at the highest level that we could, and we were very physical. Mm-hmm. The game was probably a little bit more physical in the sense that there was no protecting the quarterback. There was, late hits all the time. it was unreal.
Yeah.
In fact, playing my second year, it would be 63, playing against the Stad Sailors, I wore athletic glasses because, couldn't afford to put contacts in. And it was a third and short, and I call a quarterback sneak, so I went ahead and I had the ball in both my hands so I wouldn't fumble and just pick up the first down. And all of a sudden this hand comes in underneath my helmet.
Mm.
It takes about, the fingernails, ripping my, takes my glasses off, breaks them in half, I cannot.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Holy
oh,
tomato.
Yeah.
Wow. And, so, and you were in charge of the disciplinary committee, too, I know, later on. So, like, on the Atlantic University Sports.
Oh, yeah.
Discipline. So, like, you can only just imagine back to
well,
that.
Well, yeah, if you knew who did
wow.
it, it was a big pile.
Wow. That is unreal.
Oh,
that
yeah. The games were quite colorful.
Yeah.
And
but that's an incredible amount of pressure, too, because you knew you had to be A1 academically. But then not only are you playing against some tough competition, but you've got the roar of the crowd there. I mean, it seems like it would be the perfect combination to either chisel you into a fine instrument of academic and athletic ability, or you could crack under all that pressure.
I don't think, again, you know, our expectations in those years were so much different. I don't think anybody cracked. You know?
Yeah.
You know, you know, it's like any sport, you get people are going to freeze up a little bit at any one time, but it wasn't because of any of those reasons. It was like, we really enjoyed it. I mean, I can honestly say that I loved to go to practice. I loved to play games. I loved the whole thing of being part of a team and being around some guys that you really respected and liked. I didn't feel any pressure. Mm-hmm. You know, a coach put some pressure on you every once in a while. I remember one of his great halftimes. Again, it was against the Stadacona because the only teams that we really had to compete against was St. Evex and Stad. The rest of them, we just ran roughshod over the rest of them and won by some pretty big scores. But we came out, and I remember the first pass I threw that day was an interception, and I came to the sidelines, and Hayes was all over me. Jesus. Well, I know. Well, they didn't do it on purpose, you know.
Yeah.
wasn't my expectation either, you know. But anyway, okay, coach, yes, coach, yeah. So we came in, and we get down 14 points, and then luckily I threw a touchdown pass just before halftime, and we came in, and it's tied 14-14, so... Yeah, we go into the locker room and we think, yeah, you know, this is not bad. And
right.
The orange is there and you're taking a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
He comes storming in and it's a couple of F-bombs and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And he kicks the medical kit, which was right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's mercurochrome all over the wall, everything in it.
Yeah.
And yells about how badly we're playing and everything like that. And everybody just goes, best halftime speech I ever saw. Mm-hmm. We go out and we kind of kick butt in the second
put
half.
Put the fire in there.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Did he ever. Well, we're more afraid of him than we were anybody else. You did not want to cross Coach Hayes.
Well, that's one of the great things about, it would seem, pushing yourself, getting the desire to push yourself, having passionate people around you when you're in the institution to challenge you to push yourself. Because then once you're in the real world, you know, the so-called real world, nothing can seem like as scary or as much pressure as that. Yeah. You feel like, I've been through it now, I can keep going.
There was a lot of that, I think. And the interesting thing is when I look at all these people that I played with, and they all, you know, graduated, and, well, at least the ones that stayed, you know. Some moved on for other reasons. Some guys went to bigger schools, like American schools, and played, you know, football down there in the NCAA, and others just got homesick and stayed home, you know, for girl reasons or whatever, you know. But the ones, of course, the guys that stayed, yeah, they all did really well. And I say they did really well. Again, we came from a, you know, blue-collar background, and really well was being a school teacher, you know. And we certainly had a lot of guys that went and got their education and taught school. A lot of guys did, you know, went into business or whatever as well. But I would say they all graduated and they all provided well for their families.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Perfect. What was it like winning the big game for the university? Like, how did the university celebrate? How did the team celebrate? If you remember.
Well,
what can be said about it?
what can be said about it?
Yeah.
Well, the team celebration was wonderful. I mean, we came together. Played well, beat, you know, an upper Canada team, we're very proud of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there was adult beverages involved afterwards, but the school was good. We received Blazers because, I mean, basically back then, you're still at this university, you're just from high school to here. I went 8 straight years with wearing a sport coat tie. Well, actually, I went 12 years because in professional school you had to do the same thing at the time as well. But yeah, so it was wonderful. John Marcusino had a he was one of the local businessmen, and his wife actually was the president's secretary, and the Coach Hayes bought these Blazers and had a little football and SMU on the top pocket.
Very cool.
And I still have mine.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
so, that's nifty. Yeah. That must have been, I mean, really, like you said, again, when you come from not, a loving family and a great whatever, but essentially nothing in terms of, things handed to you, trophies or championships, all that stuff you guys had to work for, and then to have that at the end is really nice. I was wondering if the university, had done anything, because I know they make a big fuss now for championships.
You know, the Jesuits were funny. I mean, they appreciated what we did and everything, but there were expectations. They, when you went out there, they expected you to win. Mm. And they expected you to do well, both in the classroom and Father Collier was the priest that accompanied the teams. Like if you went on the road or anything like that, you always had a priest. Father Hennessy, kind of took over that position in later years, but Father Collier was the one who started it.
How did the coaching style at the time for the different sports you were involved in or that you noticed change from today's sort of team leaders and coaches in your experiences as the director?
In my time, everything was done in units, and there was no individual training. So if you were lucky enough to have some skilled people, then you did well. Then you bring in the grit, and you bring in all the other things that go with it, and the desire, determination, those kind of things would go. But there's only two coaches, at the time. And you look now, there's 11, 12, and I'm talking football, 11, 12 people out there. But they break things down now. They do more individual training. There we just had, okay, we have a bunch of plays. You run them, but you run them, and you run them, and you run them until they're perfect. There was when I was playing, and basically I was the offensive coordinator. I mean, luckily, I had a good head on my shoulders and I understood the game. I actually studied it. One of the coaches gave me a book one time on offensive, actually gave it to me on defensive football, because I was to understand what the defenses were doing and how. And the night before a game, I would know what defense would probably play against the next day, and I would diagram plays and what would work against this and this. And I had good vision that I could, when I went to the line of scrimmage, I could see that. And we were way, way ahead of the curve in the way we did things. We had the no huddle. I called the game totally without a huddle. Mm. And the ones that got really ticked off were the referees, because they just, no one had ever seen this before. Mm. That you don't go back and call a play in the huddle and come out. We went right to the line, and it really confused the defense. And but it meant you had two dummy plays and the real one, and you had a code, and everybody had to know it. And you just, that was unheard of back in the 60s. I mean, no one did that. Ended up with a migraine at the end of the day. but basically that's what we did, and we ran a. The wishbone came out with Oklahoma and Nebraska and all those. But basically, that's what we ran from a full house backfield with an options. The whole offense was an option offense. Mm-hmm. So, we were quite advanced. And the other thing that we had some pretty big guys. The guys are huge. But when you look at, our tackles were 275 pounds. We had a 300-pound defensive guy. Mm-hmm. Our backfield, I was the quarterback at 6'2", 205 pounds, which a lot of people would have people like that in the line. Mm-hmm. Paul Puma was 215. Burgess was 225. Teddy Purnell, who was just lightning fast, was 195. So, I mean, we were not small. Mm-hmm. We were a pretty good-sized team.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah. You graduated in 1966.
I did.
What were your thoughts about the university at that time? Did you feel like you would be reunited with the university someday, or did you feel like there would always be a special connection, at least, you know.
Always a special connection. Always. You know, from the first day I stepped on campus here, you know, I love the place. And I always felt that I was always treated fairly. And I must say that I probably shouldn't have been treated as fairly as I was. I was a bit of a rebel. Father Hennessy and I did butt heads more frequently than what I should have. That was my immaturity. And he handled me very well. But no, I always knew that I was wrong and would take the consequences of my actions, and for sure. And he was very quick to hand out the consequences. But no, I always knew. I never left this place. Never.
During your initial time here, there were some significant changes or developments. I'd just like to ask if you can remember or comment on any particular one. Like, for example, in 1963, the high school closed, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Do you have any memories of that?
Well, you know, it's really funny, because when I first got here, I didn't realize that the guys, we all congregate in the bottom floor of McNally, and there was a grill there, and you get hamburgers and things. It took you 6 days to chew.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bookstore was in behind it, and Frank Baldwin ran the bookstore. And then you went down the stairs, and here was the gym. That was actually the gym, and up here was the church. As you can still see, they have the windows. They're still church-type windows.
Wow.
So the probably the biggest room in the whole building was the church, Canadian Martyrs. And we just kind of mingled with those high school kids. They were all day hops.
Mm.
And some of them would come on, Jerry Redmond would come on the... But anyways, you know, a lot of these people would come right from the high school, right?
Yeah.
And it was sort of an integration. So the guys who were integrated from the high school knew all the guys in the high school, and we never treated them any differently.
Mm-hmm.
So when it closed in 63, most of the ones that were there in 63 just became St. Mary's students,
mm-hmm.
you know, university students. And you know, it wasn't a big change at all.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
In 1964, SMU withdrew from the Halifax School of Journalism, and that school closed in 1965. Was that important to any, like, your group at the time? Anybody
make
mention of that?
Pat Hickey and those guys that were doing the journal.
Yeah.
I think they felt it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But none of the people that I knew of were into becoming journalists.
Mm.
I mean, they did this, they loved it,
yeah.
But they were English majors most of the time,
right?
And
right.
They weren't journalists,
yeah.
Journalism majors. Interesting, Pat did and still does write for the Montreal Gazette.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah,
wow.
Well, he had the sports beat there for, you know, from the time he left here and, until present time. He's pretty much retired, but he still does the odd article for them.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And in 1965, the Burke Library opened.
Yeah, that was a big thing. That
yeah.
Was, that was
huge.
It
was the new facility on campus.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a great place to study, you know. Before, I mean, you had your room, and if guys were making noise and stuff like that, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
There was a big assembly room up on the third floor of McNally, but... Again, that's where the TV set was. One.
Okay, yeah.
I think it was about 21-inch black and white.
Okay, yeah, wow.
That's where everybody would do it. Congregate and
wow.
Watch Bonanza on Sunday night and you know, a couple other shows.
Yeah.
So it was, to find a real quiet place to study was not easy.
Yeah.
And the library was a huge boon for people that were academically inclined.
And in 1965, the alumni arena was opened to students, I guess.
Yeah, it was two things there. Paul Pullman and I used to run Sunday night skating. I'd be on the door, he'd be on the ice.
Was this open to everyone
in
the city?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in between my last exam and graduation, I worked over there painting all the stands and the seating.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So that would have been exciting at the time too.
Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because in the meantime, we had dropped hockey.
Mm.
Yeah. And it was only because we just didn't have a place. I used to see the hockey players. I mean, they'd be getting on a bus at probably 7:30 at night, going over to Shearwater to practice and then coming back. And it was just, it was untenable. I mean, you just couldn't keep that type of schedule for these guys. I mean, it was wonderful that Shearwater gave us the ice, and of course that would have been the connection with Coach Hayes, who was then the athletic director Hayes, and his Navy contacts. But wow, they had it tough. So, so with the advent of the rink coming, then the hockey team came.
Right. Oh, okay. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. And in 1966, there was Radio St. Mary's, but also the Students Association was incorporated. Do you remember a lot of attention or any attention by you or your peers to student unions or that sort of stuff?
Yeah, you always were associated with, you couldn't not be associated with the student union and with all the things that happened. I mean, we were just too small. At the time, I think they were under 500 male students here. So, I mean, you pretty much knew everybody. You know, sometimes you might not know the guys in engineering because it was a two-year, and then they'd go to tons after that.
Okay.
And their courses wouldn't overlap too much with you. But, yeah, you pretty much knew everybody in the school. One of the things I remember back then was Tom Haney was the head of the school security, student security.
Yeah.
And they had a mock parliament. And they had a palace revolt, say where they were going to take over parliament. And that was pretty good. There was a couple of days of turmoil. Here, but
that's great. That's great.
Oh yeah, it was great. Fairly radical, and everybody's like, "Oh my God, you can't take over Parliament." Yes, we are. This is a push, you know.
And they still say, you know, that St. Mary's is a smaller institution. Like, not obviously. Like, I mean, everybody wants small class sizes, and I always find, like, you know, it's a reasonable amount of people, and I can have one-on-one relationships with my professors. Yeah. But at a time when there's only, you know, under 1,000 students, and so many instructors, and everybody knowing everything that's going on with the school at the same time. I mean, it must have. I imagine that, like, any reunions or things like that, everybody must be very, just share all the memories because everybody was so close and was close knit. You mentioned about being offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
You know, essentially, but in 1973, you were offensive coordinator.
Yes, I was.
For the Huskies football team.
Yeah.
And they were the first to win a national college football playoff championship.
That is right.
Involving representatives from the intercollegiate leagues. Could you share some of your memories of the team at the time and SMU sports in general at that time?
Yeah, the major transition, I would say, is they were no longer student athletes. They were athlete students, at least on the football team.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a huge change in the recruitment of the student athlete, and there was a little bit more emphasis on winning football games, and we did. I mean, they were just unbelievable, the caliber of player that we had. I think out of the 73 team, I think there's as many as 13 that got drafted by the CFL. And one, Kenny Clark, played in the NFL, he played in the AFL, he played in the CFL. You know, he had just an unbelievable career as a punter and kicker. You know, Bill Robinson won the year 73, and then that was the interesting thing about the 73 team. That's the only team in history that won a college bowl or a Vanier Cup, whatever you want to call it.
Right,
now, with only 4 years of eligibility. Everybody else, the team we were playing, McGill, had 5 years. Everybody had 5 years except for this conference, and then the year, 2 years after, we went to five here. But that was the only one with 4 years of eligibility. So everybody there. So Bill Robinson went to Weston the next year and won his second college bowl as a quarterback at Weston.
Wow.
And Mike Curry went, same thing. There was a few other guys that that went to other schools.
Wow. So after having won the college bowl, later renamed the Vanier Cup, In 1986, the team was inducted into the Nova Scotia Sport Hall of Fame.
Right.
Did the university recognize this achievement at the time or since? Or?
Well, at the time, in 73, oh, I mean, it was unbelievable. We had motorcades bring us back in the city, coming back from Toronto. The premier had us down to, you know, fed us at the Parliament House, and the university would get rings to commemorate the championship. Yeah,
wow.
They treated us quite well. It was a big thing, and that was an amazing year, because in 73, you know, basketball season, the basketball team won at the time CIAU national championship. We won, and the hockey team lost the national championship by one goal to UAT, and we won football. So that's how we became the jock school.
Wow. Well, it's well earned.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. 73. That's wow. That would be interesting just to even take that year.
Oh, yeah. And just look at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had guys like Burgess, who played both on the basketball team and the football team. So he won two national championships.
Wow.
He's in the Hall of Fame. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so moving up a bit, in the 1980s, you served on the University Board of Governors.
That's correct.
Could you perhaps maybe mention some initiatives undertaken at the time you were there, or what the board was like?
Yeah, well, getting the stadium was part of it. You know, getting the artificial turf. Well, the stadium was here pretty much, but we had installed a grass field and to get the artificial surface on that happened from an athletic standpoint. Geez, isn't that funny? I'm embarrassed to say that I can't really remember a lot of the other initiatives. I know it was a time of expansion of the board, you know, and what we always said as well, you know, we're so parochial here.
Right.
You know, we have to bring in people from the outside who have not only different ideas, but also people with money that could probably help with the expansions. And of course, the campus was expanding all the time, and new residences and
was everyone agreed that there should be a focus on getting the right services for the teams, like
No. Actually, at the board level, usually athletics didn't, in my experience,
right,
didn't really make much of the agenda items.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Currently, you serve as director of athletics and recreation. Could you provide some insights on your day-to-day efforts or today's new sports endeavors, their top priorities for sports?
Well, I think today and today's athlete have changed to the extent that it's money. You know, you have to give scholarships if you're going to get the good players, and if you don't have the money to get the good players, then you're not going to be playing for many championships. Probably the exception right now is women's sports, because for some reason the women haven't caught up with the men as far as the athletic financial award needs or demands, I should say. For the guys, it's, you know, if you don't have the dough, you're not gonna bring them in, and it's more difficult. So you work as much as you can to help fundraise and bring in, you know, fill the war chest and then use it appropriately. That's a huge difference. When I played, there was no athletic scholarships. It was everybody played because they loved the game.
Right, yeah.
70s, there was some money given out, but now it's like pretty much you got to have the money or you're not going to compete. I mean, you look at Laval, privately owned, you know, huge dollars, you know, and they get whoever they want, you know. So it's difficult that way. I mean, disciplinary problems, you always have those. You always have administrative things that you have to do. It's a busy day. My wife and I were just laughing. Some of the things that I can't talk about, but I said, if people just knew what you did in the day-to-day, you know, it's, the last 4 weekends I've been in, you know, Sackville, New Brunswick, from Thursday to Sunday night, hockey. I'm the chair of the men's basketball, so I had to stay in town and from, you know, Thursday to Sunday last weekend, this past weekend, Thursday to Sunday in Fredericton, and Thursday to Sunday in Regina this weekend. So.
Oh, really?
And then come back, and we've got to get ready for the super auction, which is a huge, you know, money maker for the athletics department. For all money goes to these, the student athletes, and then we have our banquet, the athletic banquet, at the end of the end of the month. So, you know, it's just I'm 70 years old. I'm telling you, I'm starting to feel it.
Oh, well, I wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't believe that. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's quite different, obviously, than, I guess, what Coach Hayes would have been up to at the time. I mean, it's just entirely a different ball game.
It's hugely administrative.
Yeah.
Hugely administrative. And then you throw in the recreation side as well. Mm. And there you've got the whole campus. We have over 4,000 students that come and use the Humburg Center now.
Right.
And then you're looking at budgets for recreation, intramurals, you know, club teams, and where they are and how they travel. We're running, you know, camps now. We just found out we have a situation where just haul three of the instructors out because they might not be the best standings with the local police department.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And we don't want that to say, oh,
yeah. It's just so many interests to balance.
Oh, yeah.
But keeping, of course, the student, it's their best interest at the forefront of everything.
Yeah, and try to teach them, you know, I mean, about life's lessons. I mean,
the
athletes is pretty easy because, I mean, we get the big stick, you know.
Right.
If you walk over that line, then there's tremendous consequences. You won't be playing.
Right.
You'll be
going
home or whatever. And most of them will abide by the rules, the code of conduct that we have. And some of their kids, I mean, they're teenagers. I mean, they're going to make mistakes. I did, you know, and they are too.
But one of the things that you've done that's not been a mistake at all is because of your leadership and commitment to the student athlete, emphasis on student. There's a tripling of academic All-Canadians during your tenure.
Yeah.
So I guess how is St. Mary's measuring up, in your view, to ensuring now, today, a balance of academia and sport? Could you maybe enlighten us, too, about why you place an emphasis on academics?
My background.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've been Jesuit taught for 8 years, and then, you know, my professional background as being a surgeon and for 28 years, and I mean, with all the continuing education that you had to take, I mean, when I graduated with my surgery, we did everything extra. We cut the face for everything, and by the time I finished, we didn't cut the face at all, you know, other than cleft lips. I mean, but it was, everything was done intraorally. We did all this massive facial changes. The whole way of doing surgery changed, and then you're doing things with scopes instead of, you know, making big incisions. And yeah, it's always, you know, the pursuit of academic excellence has always been part of my life, and my mind was always open to new ideas and trying to learn new things. Prolific reader, just, you know, love to learn new things, even at my age now. So. I try to pass that on, and the way you do it, first of all, is with the coaches and make sure that, okay, when you're recruiting somebody, you know, let's not have a one-year wonder. That's not going to work. You have somebody you can bring in, has got good character, and that you can bring along, coach them up. And it's a slower process, there's no question. I mean, in the 73, we brought in a lot of one-year wonders. You know, the last two, because you can't usually fail out completely in 1 year. It usually takes you 2 years to do it completely. And that's not the type of student athlete we want here. You know, we'll have less problems on the outside of, you know, the campus, or even on the campus. And you'll have people that you can be very proud of. We had our academic All-Canadian dinner, I think it was 2 weeks ago. And it's a really proud night. I mean, these kids are outstanding. We have four or five of them that have a 4.30 GPA, which means they have all A pluses on their transcript. There's not anything less than an A plus. And I look at that and go, holy smokes, now that's commitment. A lot of fours, high threes, you know, well, to be an academic All-Canadian, you need 3.6 anyway. So, yeah, it's really, really a wonderful night. They bring their favorite professor, and of course the parents, and so it's the highlight of my year, anyways.
Oh, great! That's great. Yeah.
And you project that out. You just say, look, this is important. These people are. We have our awards banquet. All the academic all stand up. You guys are really special. You're scholar athletes. You're not student athletes. You're scholar athletes. You know, and try to, you know, push everybody. The coaches will push them, you know, athletically, but we got to make sure that all of us are on the same page and pushing academically as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's perfect. All the questions I had, and thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Oh,
I really,
yeah,
really appreciate it.
Oh no, it's a pleasure. I always love to talk. Yes, yeah, you know, get me talking about St. Mary's, and I love it.
No, I mean, it sounds like you found. Well, it sounds like, for one thing, you've got quite a balancing act to do, and as director, you know. But it makes me happy to know how you're thinking about it, you know what I mean? It makes me appreciate it as a student here, because you're thinking about balance of all this different stuff, and keeping the prestige of the institution and all that is essential. It's great. And then two, positing the idea that, you know, there are these trophies and then there are these trophies, and they look best together, as opposed to if you only have one or the other,
Oh, yeah.
Sort of
absolutely.
Thing. So. Yeah, all right, great, fantastic.
Yeah, that's great.
See you.